I have to say, with respect to Alex, though, that even though I did not take his class, there are very few professors and really very few mentors who have had such a tremendous impact on my life and certainly served to change the course of my career. When I came to this university, I did come from a very small school in Ohio that I loved. Everybody, of course, is familiar with the metropolis of Cedarville, Ohio. Yeah. But one thing that Alex did do, he had the vision of bringing a group of us students together before law school started to instill in us the belief that we could accomplish anything that we put our minds to. And without that vision, without that dedication to a group of very young, very scared students, I can tell you that at least there is one student who can tell you that he wouldn't have made it without that vision and without that sacrifice. So it is a pleasure to be back in the school that I love. It is never an arm twist for me to come down to Charlottesville. One, I love it, it's beautiful. I met my wife here, I got married here, and as I'm fond of saying, over the last 3 years, I have been in a lot worse places. Normally, they've been occupied by owners in the National Football League. Alex asked me, well, why would you never have anything down here? This is a sanctuary. So I believe in keeping, as the old McDLT commercial, the hot side hot and the cold side cold. None of them are old enough to know what that means. For me, it's important to have a place where I know is dedicated to the beauty of learning, to challenging students to not only understand the law, but challenging them to understand things in a different way and to have the courage and the resolve to take that education not only seriously, but understanding how important it is to our community. So for the next 15, 20 minutes, I'd like for you to indulge me a little bit as we talk about what I believe is a critical question. The obligation of being a good sport. The obligation of being a good sport. And while some of you might think that the recent news about the bounty, the issue unfolding over the last few weeks in New Orleans, might have been the reason why I wanted to talk about the obligation of being a good sport, let me just start off by saying that that is not the motivation for the talk. It's not. While I do believe that there is an obligation to being a good sport in the traditional way in which we think about it, being a good sportsman, being a good sport with respect of athletes to athlete, I also believe that there are at least five obligations that are included in that obligation to being a good sport. One, obviously, is the obligation athlete to athlete, the obligation to be a good sport. But I also believe that there is an obligation from, indeed, the sport to the athlete. There is an obligation of what society has or fans have to an athlete. There is an obligation of that athlete to the greater society. And finally, there is certainly an obligation of third parties to the sport. So the obligation of whether there is an obligation of being a good sport for the next few minutes, while it is important and certainly critical that we respect and understand what it means to be a good sportsman in the theme of being a good sport, for the next few minutes, I would like to hopefully convince you that there is an obligation of being a good sport when you look at the sport itself. So just for a second, and I do believe in answering questions, and we can certainly talk about anything, I'd like to focus us on that unique obligation of being a good sport when it comes to the sport itself. And I hope to answer, at least challenge you with two questions. Is there an obligation for there to be a good sport? And I hope that you will join me in reaching a conclusion that the answer is yes. And then second, three things of recognizing when we do not have a good sport, and hopefully understanding that those are three things that we always have to be vigilant against and dedicate ourselves to fixing. So first, is there an obligation of being a good sport? Yes. And I would argue that It is accepted within our culture, within our morality, within our understanding about our place in society, that there has to be a good sport. Why? One, we never, never embrace anything in a sport where violence is the only end of the sport, where violence is the only goal. That is not a sport. We do not worship, we don't accept, we never condone violence just for the sake of violence. Because why? We believe that as a society we have a greater obligation to each other than just to reward mere violence. So I did grow up in outside of Washington, D.C., in a place called Glen Arden, Maryland, right around the corner from a place called Palmer Park. And when Sugar Ray Leonard went to the Olympics, every kid in my neighborhood joined the Palmer Park Boxing League. And unlike every other kid, I got the bejesus beat out of me. I was not a particularly good boxer, unless you consider boxing to be taking as many blows as possible. My problem with boxing was I did not like getting hit. My other problem with boxing was I didn't particularly enjoy hitting other people. So other than managing those two things, I'm sure I would have had a terrific future being a boxer. But whether you look at boxing, MMA fighting, any other sport, football, that includes with it a physicality where there is the potential for people getting hurt, where there is at times a great amount of collision or force between two combatants. I dare anyone to find one of those sports where we operate without what? Rules. Where we look upon two combatants, where we try to do our best to make sure that there is what? Parity between them. Where we nonetheless require that even though the sport may involve moments of physical force, that we would nonetheless disqualify someone if they broke the very rules that form the paradigm of that sport. We do not accept violence as its own end. So whether you look at something like boxing or football or hockey or MMA fighting or anything else that falls into that, I believe that that nonetheless is a good sport and that we require that sport to be good simply because we impose upon it rules and parity and fairness. And we look to find the athletic grace that may nonetheless not be apparent initially. So I do believe that there is an obligation of there being a good sport. I do believe that there is an obligation of sport to an athlete that is just as important as the obligation between athletes to each other. So three things or three factors that has become apparent to me of when we have not reached that mark, when we have failed to at least ensure that sport is in itself good. First, if we make the mistake of treating our participants in sports as athletes first, I would argue to you, we have failed in our obligation of being a good sport. If we start off with viewing the participants in that sport as something less than people, we have failed in our obligation to ensuring that we are engaged in being a good sport. And while football is sometimes, and I must admit this, and I know it may even sound like sacrilege, even though football is first and foremost on my mind, there are those days when I choose not to think about football. I know it comes as a shock. I am proud to say that I have coached my daughter's basketball team and my son's basketball team for 7 years. I've coached baseball. And the greatest thrill of my life during the last 3 years of what some say I shouldn't have called a war, but I know that it was a war, I never missed a game. and I never missed a practice. Why? Because I dig coaching my kids and spending the time with them. And whether we were involved in a war over the business of football, there does come a time when there are things more important than football. So I will step to the left and hopefully avoid the lightning bolt that is certainly to strike me dead. But there is. If we make the mistake of starting off treating the participants as in any sport as only having a significance because they are in the sport, I dare and I will challenge anybody. We have started off making a mistake. So, for example, in this new collective bargaining agreement, for the first time in history, we made it an obligation that every medical professional in football honor and conform to every federal, state, local, ethical, and professional standard. Now, certainly that was a good day for the players of the National Football League, and certainly it was a good day for those players who will all become former players. But if it is 2011, and that is the first time in history that it has been codified that medical doctors have to obligate themselves to the same federal, state, local, professional, and ethical standards as every other doctor in the country, I think we can all make the argument that that's probably 100 years too late. So why did it take nearly 50 years, 60 years of organized football in order to get to a moment in time where you would obligate a doctor to follow the same rules as he or she would when they treat you? Because for those many years, we've believed that there was a football exception. A football exception. So when doctors prescribe Vicodin, like you would hand out Chiclets to a child, no one thought or believed or wanted to put themselves in a position to say that that's wrong. And while all of us will enjoy certainly sport while we're watching ESPN or watching the coverage by Sports Illustrated or any other media outlet, it is the rare occurrence that anyone would want to stray into that almost sacred area where someone was going to say, wait a minute, maybe the obligation of a doctor, perhaps even the Hippocratic Oath, may indeed apply to football, where every doctor takes that sacred oath that we all know of what? First, do no. This is a public interaction. First, do no what? Harm. But I know and I firmly believe that if we end up in a world where we start off looking at an individual, not as an individual first, but as an athlete first, that's how you lead yourself to the football exception. Because while, hopefully, this is the answer, any one of you would go to your doctor having twisted your ankle in the dangerous sport of walking down the hall on your way to class, which can be done, and you went to your doctor and you said, hey doc, I understand you have this Hippocratic Oath, but you know, tomorrow I have to walk to class, so I do need a shot of Toradol, I do need two or three Vicodin in order to make my way to class today. My hope is that most of your doctors would say, no. And even on the off chance that it was that day, that North Ground Softball League Championship, where you did say to yourself, doc, I've got to play. That one day where your doctor said, I understand that this is important to you, I understand what North Grounds means. And he did give you that, my employers really weren't that sweet. And he did give you that narcotic, and you did take it and you did play. all of our hopes would be that the next day when you went in and said, I need two more, our hopes would be that your doctor would say what? No. But for some reason, there's a football exception, where day after day after day, that answer is yes. And why? Because somehow we started off looking at them as athletes first and not persons first. Second factor or issue to me that demonstrates that you are no longer on the path for a good sport is if you then treat that individual not as an athlete first, but not as a person first, but as an athlete first, and then for whatever reason, your next step is that that athlete, when it comes to that sport, is what? Fungible. Disposable. Discardable. Where the identity of that athlete or that social worth of that athlete is only defined by whether or not that athlete is a participant in that sport at that time. So I must tell you that I have been called or identified by at least people in our staff, people I don't know, people I've met on the street, owners of the National Football League, as someone who does have a bad temper. Frankly, I don't know what they're talking about. I'm afraid of my wife. And my dad, and my kids. But you know, that's about it. So yes, are there times when some people get a dose of evil D? Yes. And I can tell you that the one time that it is guaranteed to be kicked off is when they refer to our men as gladiators. I will do my best to twist your head off like a top when you refer to our players as gladiators, because they are not. What is a gladiator? A reference to old Rome, where people fought to the death for the amusement of people who weren't fighting. So the day that any one of you would like your son or your daughter to be referred to as a gladiator, hopefully, that will never be the case. But when we are in a paradigm where players are viewed as discardable or fungible or as a gladiator, I know that we have moved to a world where we are not on track for it to be a good sport. So it is to that issue of first do no harm, whether we perpetuate a world that we are in right now where people other than medical doctors dispense prescription drugs to our players, where very few of our players have ever taken a stress test, where virtually none of our players are required to do baseline testing every year when it comes to something as liver function. And while we have moved tremendously since 2009 on the issue of concussions, when we are in a world where there is or are people who are not qualified to make decisions on whether a player can return to play, I know we have not arrived at that world where we know that we are engaged in perpetuating a good sport. But it also means that if we believe or if we accept any sport or any university or any college or any governing body like the NCAA that believes that it no longer has an obligation to that person after they are done competing in that sport, I know that we have not arrived where we've accepted an obligation of being a good sport. So if we are in a world where college athletes lose health care for the injuries that they suffer while they're playing a collegiate sport, how many people would believe that we've adopted or accepted our obligation of being a good sport. While everyone wants to automatically turn the issue of amateur athleticism into a fundamental question or a myopic question of whether players should be paid or not, it does seem to me that the real question is, should those athletes be any less than people? If you are in a world where a collegiate athlete is playing a college sport at a large school and yet lives below the poverty line, have we achieved a level of where we believe that that person, not athlete, person, is being afforded the same respect, courtesy, and obligations that we would all want for our sons and daughters? So I know that, at least from the NCAA side, people got very nervous after I gave a New York Times article, and yes, sometimes the goal is to indeed make people nervous. I dig that. But sometimes it's important to do something so that we start asking the right questions. The right questions. I don't pretend to have any of the answers. But I do believe that our job, our role, the profile of our sport obligates us to push people to ask the right questions. So when, one, you look at whether or not people are treated as people first before being athletes, second, whether there is a perception that they are fungible or discardable, the third indicator that we are not on the track of knowing that we are building a good sport is if we then, and I mean all of us, make the mistake of then studying or discussing our athletes as objects rather than subjects. And while, you know, you and I had a brief chance to talk earlier about sort of the future of what this program is, I would urge anyone who cares about this subject, wants to study the idea of sport, to challenge yourself to break out of the norm. And the issue that I like to talk about, this global issue, is what I would believe is called the philosophy of sport. It's broader than just the issue of ethics. It's broader than just the issue of cheating. It's broader than just the issue of the business of sports, sports marketing, labor relations. It's much broader than that. Because all of us at this great institution, all of us in society at large, have an obligation of constantly challenging how do things fit in our understanding of society? How do things fit with our understandings or belief of what? Fairness and civil rights. So if we confine ourselves to only studying things under the myopic lens of the business of the sport or the athlete of the sport, I would once again argue that we are moving down the road where we are not moving towards an obligation of creating or preserving a good sport. For example, when we started this fight, the league had a certain hankering for 18 games. 18 football games. And at every turn, the only discussion amongst the media, the only discussion amongst the owners, even the only discussion amongst the fans was what? Well, you know, fans don't like two preseason games. Well, as a former Redskin ticket, season ticket holder, guess what? Neither do I. Well, because they're included in your season ticket package. But to me, the gall or the problem of an 18-game schedule, and worse yet, the paradigm of the discussion, was that no one pulled back to ask the question except us, what's happening to our men under a 16-game schedule as it is? Dave Megacy wrote a book almost 20 years ago where he talked about the overprescription of pain-killing drugs, how players engage in self-medication, the abuse of alcohol under the guise of what? You gotta play through pain. Well, the reality is, the way this game is being played now, you can ask a serious question, are we playing too much already? We know that our players leave this game, our men leave this game broken. And while everyone or some are fond of talking about the stories about how large salaries are blown, large fortunes are lost, how there is an irresponsibleness on behalf of some players in the way in which they manage their money, very few people want to talk about the reality that up until the current collective bargaining agreement, you had to play 3 years in the National Football League in order to get any post-career health care. That if you played less than the 3 years it took to vest, you did not get any post-career health care. That right now, the National Football League is fighting the union, our union, in over 400 workers' comp cases where players are trying to get compensation and coverage for medical care for the injuries they suffered while playing in the business of football. Where very few people that even though we have come a long way from the days where I started this job, where the head of the NFL's concussion committee was a rheumatologist. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And while we are now in a world where we do have better benefits, where we do have a better focus on concussions, that today, that even though we have now created injury guarantees for the first time in contracts for up to 3 years, the National Football League has taken a position with respect to a player who suffered several concussions, where his doctor said that you cannot play football anymore because you've suffered too many concussions, where the team doctor has said you have suffered too many concussions and we don't recommend you play football anymore, the National Football League has taken the position legally that since that player is no longer symptomatic about his concussions, that he is not entitled to the benefits that players pay for. So it is upon all of us not just to be satisfied with the traditional coverage of our sport, the traditional coverage of our business. It is indeed incumbent upon us, and certainly people here, that we take upon ourselves the obligation of studying, discussing, analyzing, questioning, pushing, pulling, tearing apart issues where we start, where any of us would want someone else to start with us. You are an individual. You are a person. And if we are unable or unwilling to study those issues with that as a starting point, I know that we are not on the road of ensuring or abiding by our obligations to be a good sport. So what do we do? How do you get there? Well, one, two simple things. One, while we spend a tremendous amount of time studying the business of our sport, we do have to apply ourselves to understanding the importance of courage, leadership, sacrifice. For me, in this movement, have I become a dyed-in-the-wool union guy? Oh, yeah. And there's never going to be a day that I'm going to apologize for it. So the more interesting transition that few people talk about, how does a lawyer go from representing the largest corporations in the world to going completely to the other side, working, representing people who work for a living? Pretty smoothly, to be dead honest with you. Why? Because I get the fundamental battle between labor and management. So the people that I look to, Cesar Chavez and the migrant farm worker movement, if you do not know who Mary Harris Jones is and you want to study things like labor relations or how to ensure that the people you represent are treated fairly, you'll never understand what you're doing. If you can't look to people like A. Philip Randolph and understand what it takes to organize, to lead a group of people to stand up and fight for their own causes, you won't have a chance. So in great universities like this, where you can actually embrace learning, where we have always historically steered away from teaching just simple black letter law, where your professors, and they drove me crazy, pounding on you ideas about the philosophy of law and how you go about analyzing problems and thinking your way through it. There are indeed some places, thankfully, that still get it right. So I have to say, when I was at the AFL-CIO meeting last week, and we were in our executive committee session, and we go around the table talking about the challenges that we're facing, a man named John Wilhelm, who leads the Union Unite here, spoke up and told of a story about a University of Virginia football player who had engaged in a hunger strike here in order to support the rights of campus workers. You cannot imagine the pride and the emotion when you hear that story. Not only about a young man who loves the game as much as I do, obviously a young man who could play it much better than I ever could, but understanding the sacrifice and the courage and the leadership in a young man to take upon himself an issue that ordinary people would say didn't involve him, and to embrace something that was much larger than himself. So when you hear about a young man named Joseph Williams, you can actually dig it. And then to understand later on that you know a man named Tom Carter, who was your coach. A man in our organization that I love to death. Not because he was a great Redskin. Yes, I did grow up a Redskin fan. But men like Tom Carter taught me things about sacrifice. So I do know that there are places, and I do certainly know that there are individuals who still get it right. And thank you for that. So what do? We take upon ourselves the obligation of ensuring a good sport. And we make sure that it is not only our professional obligation, we take upon ourselves that it is our personal obligation. And the last thing I will say, leaving out of here, the reason why I am confident that we can do it, no one, and I mean no one, is an expert about your own potential. Only you. And to be at a university that continues to get it right, to know that there are young people out there who will continue to fight to get it right, we're going to be in good hands. Thank you very much.